This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Difficult to understand, but we've worked on in the previous shiurim. Ma'ase b'talmid echad shel Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. There was a case with a particular talmid of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, sheyotzo chutz loretz, who went to chutz loretz. He left Eretz Yisrael and he had to go overseas. Uvo oshir, and he came back a little while later, and he came back very wealthy. And obviously, with the talmidim, the people learning with Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai were terribly poor. V'hoyu ha'talmidim ro'yen oiso u'mekanin boi. And the other Talmidim saw him and became very jealous that after a short time overseas he came back with such wealth and such good fortune, and they're suffering such terrible poverty. And they wanted also to go to Chutz Loretz. They thought, what is it? So you go for a couple of years, it's not the end of the world. If you can come back and support yourself and live with such affluence afterwards, surely it's worth taking a couple of years off and doing a bit of business overseas. The Yoda Rabbi Shimon, and Rabbi Shimon knew that. By the fact that the Medrash tells us that Rabbi Shimon knew that, that means they didn't actually express it to Rabbi Shimon, otherwise of course he would have known. He perceived it, he realized they wouldn't have actually said it, but deep down inside them there was a desire to travel overseas and make some money. And he took them out into a valley in Pnei Madoi. And he started davening Rabbi Shimon and Yochai. A strange tefillah he started to daven. The Omar, he said the following: Biko, Biko, O valley, valley, Milu Dinore Zohov, Milu Dinore Zohov, fill yourself with golden Krugerrands. Hitchilo Meshechis Dinore Zohov Lifnehem. And Krugerrands started falling out of the sides of the mountain, and the valley just got fuller and fuller and fuller of these mountains and mountains of gold coins. If it's gold that you wanted, you want money. I didn't know you wanted money. If you wanted money, here's as much as you want. Take whatever you want. But you need to know. Whoever takes money now is taking his olam haba. Because the reward for learning Torah is olam haba. So this, all this gold, you can take as much as you want, but you need to realize it comes off your account at the end. It comes off your Olam Haba account. It's one story. The next one is even a more peculiar story. Rabbi Shimon Chalafta came in Erev Shabbos and he had nothing to eat. Nothing in the home, there was no food, nothing, no wine to drink, absolutely nothing, and he couldn't afford to buy. So Erev Shabbos, he went out of town. V'ispalel lifnei Elokim, he davened before Hashem. V'nisam loy even toiva min hashamayim, and a precious stone came down from heaven. He didn't seem to be terribly surprised. He took the stone, put it in his pocket. Nosno l'shulchono, he came into town, gave it to a dealer. Ufirne says a Shabbos, and he had plenty to eat for that Shabbos from the money he got from that stone. Omro ishto, and he came home with this. All sorts of delicacies that he bought. She said to him, "Mehecho neilu, where did you get this?" Omar lo mimashi pirnes hakadosh baruch hu. She said, "God gave it to me." He said, "God gave it to me." Omro, she said, "Imein ata oimeli mehechen hein eni teemes klum. Unless you tell me where it comes from, I won't eat a thing. If you want me to enjoy the Shabbos and to eat with you, you'd better tell me where it comes from, otherwise I won't touch it." Yitzil mesafel lo. So he told her the story. I went out and davened before Hashem. I said, "Please Hashem, I need some money." Hashem gave me a precious stone. I went to the dealer and changed it, and I bought. I won't taste a thing unless you promise me that you'll give the stone back to Hashem after Shabbos. It's a good thing to say. How do you do that? To get the stone from Hashem is already a miracle. How do you get it back to the Ribbono Shel Olam? But she didn't seem to find that very difficult. She wanted a promise from him that he would do so. Amar lo lamo, she said, "Why?" Amar lo, she said, "Atareitze sheyei shulchon chachosel v'shulchon chaver chomale." Do you want to sit at a table that is missing, that is lacking, while your friends sit at a table that is full? Meaning in Olam Habo. V'holach Rabbi Shimon v'hidiya maisel Rebbe. So Rabbi Shimon didn't know quite how to deal with his wife. So he told the story to Rebbe. Whole story. Hamalei Rebbe laughed and said to him, Lech Emel, again tell your wife, Im Shulchoncha Choser, Ani Amaleinu Mishili. If we get to Olam Habo, and there's anything missing from your table, I'll make it up from my table. She doesn't have to worry. It'll all be alright. So he felt very good. He's finally got an answer for his wife. He doesn't have to figure out a way to get the stone back to Hashem. So he went very confidently and happily to tell his wife, and he discussed it with his Rebbe, and his Rebbe said there's nothing to worry about, and in fact if there's anything missing from their table, he'll make it good. So she says, take me to whoever this is who teaches you Torah. I don't know what kind of a Rebbe he is. Let me go and talk to him. So he went, he took her. She comes before Rebbe and she says to him, Rebbe, do you think we're going to see each other in Olam Habo? Do you think we're going to meet up there? Don't we learn that every tzaddik has a world of his own? It says, and a man will go to the house of his world. It doesn't say to the house of world, it says to his, the house of his world. Each one has their own world up there. We won't be able to get anything from you. Kivan Sheshomo Kein Holach Vehechazi. When Rebbe heard that, and the husband heard that, he went and he gave the stone back to Hashem. Rabbi Sein Omru Anesu Achrono Yokoshim Arishon. And the Chazal say the second miracle was greater than the first one. Getting the stone from Hashem wasn't as hard as returning it to Hashem. Kivan Sheposhat Yodo Lachaziro. He stretched his hand out with the stone in it. Miad Yorod Hamalach Unatolo Himeno. An angel came and took it from him. Because the reward for Torah is only in Olam Haba. Those are the two stories the Midrash tells us in this week's Sabbath. Very difficult stories that we need to deal with. The one is this exchangeability of reward in the world to come with gold and precious stones just doesn't seem to be right. That question the Tzelzer Rov deals with. And he says that we need to change our perspective of the world to come and our perspective of reward in the world to come. That what's in the world to come is not something which is separate and detached from what's in this world, including our own Sechah. And as we've learned, those of us who've learned it, the Derech Hashem will remember the principle of Ishtalshelus, that really it's the same item that manifests itself in different ways depending on what spiritual level it's manifesting itself. It can manifest itself in the Olam Haba in a purely spiritual sense, in a purely spiritual manifestation, and that same thing manifests itself in this world in a purely physical manifestation, but it's the same thing. And one can exchange one for the other. One can deal in any form one wants to deal in, but it's the same object that one's dealing. Those gold coins that filled up the valley, that wasn't instead of reward in the world to come. He wasn't saying, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai wasn't saying, take this instead of your world to come. He's saying, this is it. Your world to come has simply been transferred into something physical, into something material, and you can take it in the material form if you want. But you need to know that there's nothing left then for Olam Haba, you're using it up. I suppose to understand it, it's something like understanding the relationship between solids, liquids, gases, it's the same thing. Take water and you can freeze it into a solid. It's not that you've got the solid instead of the water. If you want your water at minus 4 degrees centigrade, it's going to be in the form of a solid. And you can choose it. That's how you want it. You'll get a solid. If you want it at over 100 degrees centigrade, then you're going to get it in a gas form. But it's the same water. You can have it in whatever form you want. If you want to drink it, it needs to be in a liquid. If you want to store it in a fridge, it can be in a solid form. If you want to just to moisturize the air, it can be in a gas form. Depends what you want, but it's the same water. And so it is with Olam Haba. You want it in gold coins, you can have it in gold coins. You want to transfer those gold coins into something more spiritual, then they will be something more spiritual. But it's the same item that manifests itself in different forms. From the one extreme being totally spiritual to the other extreme being totally physical, and various grades in between. That's how the Tzelzer Rov explains it. Now, I've got a difficulty with that in trying to understand what was Rebbe's view in the beginning, and what did she do to change Rebbe's mind? when he came, when Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta came to Rebbe and said, my wife says she doesn't want to eat any of the food because I must give the stone back, he laughed at her and at him and says, tell her not to worry, if there's anything missing from your table, I'll make it good. She comes to him and says, but we're not going to be able to do that up there. We can't exchange up there. So he withdraws. And the husband withdraws. So what was his view first? What did she teach Rebbe that Rebbe didn't know before? So it would appear that we've got to understand it slightly differently with this, with a slight variation to it, a slight refinement to it. And that is, the Gemara says in various places that people who are showing, people whose negative points exceed their positive points, get paid out for their good points in this world, in Olam Hazeh. Whatever good they did, they get paid in this world. And tzaddikim, people whose positive points exceed their negative points, get paid for their negative in this world, and all their positive stays for Olam Hazeh. What does that really mean? It's not just a question of having the option of being able to go into the valley and saying, I want the Olam Haba to be converted into gold coins. It's not so simple. Sometimes we don't have the option. And the Ribbono Shel Olam pays us in the currency that we show him we are dealing in. It's not a question of making a choice, I want it in this currency or in that currency. Whatever currency we deal in, that's the currency in which Hashem pays us. So if we deal in material things, if our life revolves around material things, if we do things for material motivation and for material profit, then Hashem will pay us materially, even for the good things we do. If we do things spiritually, that even the material things we do for spiritual motivation, then even for the material things, Hashem will pay us spiritually. So in theory, you've got two types of human beings on two different scales, on the two ends of the scale. You've got one human being who even the spiritual things that he does, even the mitzvahs he does with a material motivation. As the Gemara says, a person goes and studies Torah because he wants to become a rabbi, and earn a living becoming a rabbi. It's material motivation. He does mitzvahs because he wants kovod, he wants people to see him, whatever the reason. So take it on the lowest level where even the mitzvahs that a person does are entirely materially motivated. He's living in a material world and he values things in a material way. Hashem will give him his reward in materialism. On the other end of the scale, you can have a person who even the physical things he does are for spiritual reasons. He eats for spiritual reasons, he works for spiritual reasons, he has leisure for spiritual reasons. Everything he does is really working in Ruchnius. All he's interested in is spiritual things. He's interested in his Olam Haba. That's the only profit that means anything to him. So for him, even the physical things he does gets reward in Olam Haba. But there are very few people who are on either end of the scale. Most of us are somewhere in between. And so we have certain things that we do physically and certain things that we do spiritually. And in every mitzvah there's probably a bit of both. In every mitzvah that we do, there's a certain amount that we do in a physical sense and there's a certain amount that we do in a spiritual sense. So part of our reward is kept for Olam Haba and part of our reward is kept for Olam Hazeh. So when Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta comes to Rebbe and tells him the story, I got this precious stone from Hashem, Rebbe thinks to himself, this isn't some of Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta's Olam Haba that is being paid in a material way. This is physical reward which has been set aside, which is now drawing on. Let me give you an example. What is this concept, this Kabbalistic concept that the Talmud Rav talks about? And the example I gave you is the example of water changing to a solid or to a gas. It's the same water. We can look at it in a different way too. We can look at it in economics, in a financial sense. You can have money, and in fact that's how one should look at any amount of money. Money is having a present value and money is having a future value. If you have 100 rand, it's worth 100 rand today. If you leave the 100 rand under your mattress, next year it will be worth 80 rand, and the following year it will be worth 50 rand, if that. If you invest it, and you invest it well, then next year it will be worth not 80 rand, it will be worth 90 rand only. If you invest it very well, it might be worth 110 rand. Someone has to look at it and say, in terms of the investments that are available to one, what is its present value, what is its future value? And that's how we have to see also our deeds in terms of Olam Haba. When we do something that earns us schar, that earns us reward, we do a good deed, we do a mitzvah, that earns us reward, it has a present value and it has a future value. And we can opt, so to say, whether to leave it invested and to draw on its future value sometime in the future, or to draw on it now. Now, if one earns 6,000 rand a month, and one needs, in order to live, 5,000 rand a month, so one draws one's 5,000 rand, you don't think of yourself of drawing that 5,000 rand, you don't think of taking away from your nest egg. That's not what it is, that's your income, which is used to live today. You're using its present value because you need its value in the present. It doesn't help you to have it invested, you've got to pay for your bills. Your extra 1,000 rand, that you put away for a future value. And what happens if one month you didn't have much expense, it so happens you only had to spend 4,000 rand? So then you've got an extra 1,000 rand to put away for future value. And different people, depending on their value systems and on their lifestyles, will draw more or less for the present and more or less for the future. When Rabbi Shimon ben Tachlafta told Rebbe that he got the stone, how did Rebbe see that? That Hashem was giving him some of his future investment, that he was taking off his retirement pension and he was paying him now instead? Rebbe didn't think of Rabbi Shimon ben Tachlafta as being so hard up for schar that Hashem would have to, if he wants to give him some present value, he would have to take it off from the future. Surely there's plenty that's left in his daily income. Every day there's money coming in, so to say. Surely there's enough for a Shabbos. That's all he needed was for a Shabbos. That's not drawing on a future income. That's what Rebbe meant. I'll make up for you. It's not coming off your table in Olam Habo. You're doing so much, Rabbi Shimon ben Tachlafta. You and your wife and your family are doing so much every minute of the day. Reward is coming, and this is just a fraction of your daily drawings which Hashem has supplied you with. True, you opt to draw very little. That's the way you like it. You prefer to live in poverty, and most of it gets put away for a future value. So yeah, Hashem's given you a little bit from what you've earned now, but it's not taking away from anything from Olam Habo. It's your present earnings that this is. Not so when he meets Mrs. Rabbi Shimon ben Tachlafta. When he meets Rabbi Shimon's Rebbetzin, he realizes this is a different story altogether. He realizes that this Rebbetzin doesn't live for Olam Hazeh at all. She couldn't care less if there's nothing to eat for Shabbos. All she's interested in is Olam Hazeh. Most of us are interested in both. Some of us are interested only in Olam Hazeh. And some of us are interested mostly in Olam Hazeh and a little bit in Olam Habo. And some of us are interested in 50-50. We like Olam Hazeh, we like Olam Habo. But there are not many of us who are not interested in Olam Hazeh at all. We couldn't care less about this world. It just makes no difference whatever. Whether I'm healthy or not healthy, whether I've got money or I haven't got money, got what to eat, haven't got it. Makes no difference as long as my Olam Habo is okay. That's all that's important. Very few people live on that level. But Rebbe Shimon ben Tachlafta does. And when Rebbe realizes that she lives on that level, he realizes that all their earnings are going into Olam Habo. And Takashi's right. Anything they take now is going to diminish from that Olam Habo. They don't draw at all on their Olam Habo account. Most people draw of their daily earnings. A certain amount goes to keep body and soul together, and a certain amount, and it's a small percentage maybe. A mitzvah, how much of a mitzvah has to go to give us enough schus to be able to live ordinarily? There is such incredible reward for every mitzvah. So it's a small, small percentage of the mitzvahs we do goes to give us the credit we need in order to live physically, in order to live materially. And 99% of it gets put away for Olam Habo. But in her case, 100% was being put away for Olam Habo. She drew nothing, she wanted nothing. She was living completely in an Olam Habo value system. In that case, Rebbe withdraws and says, in that case, it's true. She's gay, so this does come from Olam Habo. Because every penny that they earn gets put away in Olam Habo. They don't keep anything at all for themselves here. And so he withdraws. But there's a bit of a contradiction in the Medrash itself. He says, Rebbe says to Rabbi Shimon ben Tachlafta, if you find that your table is lacking anything, I'll make up for it. He tells his wife, and she says, I'll have none of this. Doesn't he know that we're going to be in different worlds up there? And how would you like, what did she say to her husband? How would you like to come there and your table is full, and your table is empty and other people's are full? How would you like that? So Rabbi says, but I'll make up. If your table is missing anything, I'll make up. She comes along and she says, but we'll be in different worlds. So why doesn't he answer this? And what are you worried about? If we'll be in different worlds, how will you know that other people's tables are fuller than ours? What does it bother you? Her whole claim is that. What does she say? She says, I won't eat from it at all. Do you want your table to be missing something and your friend's table will be full? Is that what you would like? To sit there and see that other people have got more than you've got? Won't be nice. But afterwards she says everybody's in a different world and they're not even going to meet up there. So what does it bother her either way? If everybody's in a different world, what does it bother her if there's a little bit missing from her table? And if they are going to meet up there, then Rebbe is right. If you're missing anything, he's given a guarantee. I'll make up for it. There's another interesting medrash. Here we've said that it's not possible to get all your payout in terms of gold krugerrand. Because Olam HaBo is worth so much more, it can't be translated completely. The Talmud Rav seems to imply that it can. That your whole Olam HaBo can be translated into krugerrand. That's what you want. And there'll be nothing left for Olam HaBo. And we're saying that it doesn't seem to be so simple, and that otherwise, what did Rebbe think before? What was Rebbe's view? So Rebbe's view was only a very small part, and it didn't really come with the Olam HaBo account. We're saying that there's a part of one's schar which is transferable into material things, and there's part of one's schar which is just spiritual. But the Medrash says in Parshas Lech Lecho and Parshas Mem Dalet that the Ribbono Shel Olam had to give Avraham certain assurances because he was afraid. Avraham Avinu was afraid and he said, "Yoradati lekivshon ha'esh v'nitzalti. I went down into the furnace of fire and I came out alive. Yoradati lemilchemes hamalochim. I went to fight the kings in Sodom v'nitzalti and I was saved. Maybe I have already received my reward in this world and there is nothing left for the world to come." How can Avraham Avinu say such a thing? Avraham Avinu is such a tzaddik, as he himself says, has been meiser nefesh, he's given up his life twice in order to do the Ratzon Hashem. So his schar must be enormous. How could he think for a minute that he's been paid in Olam Hazeh? With what? On those two occasions, because he was saved, he's been paid for his Olam Habo. And paid entirely, because here it says, not like she says, that Shulchon Chochosa, maybe there'll be something missing from my table. He says, the only Kum Leosid. Maybe, says Avraham Avinu, there'll be nothing left for me in Olam HaBo. That's what I'm afraid of, not a diminished Olam HaBo. Maybe I've got every bit of it, and there'll be nothing left. Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Hashem says to him, Altiro Anoichi Mogen Lecho, I'm protecting you, V'chol Ma'ashi Osisi Imcho Be'olam HaZeh Chinom Osisi Imcho. Whatever I've done for you, Avraham, I did for nothing. And Chaim Shmulevitz used to point out that means, I did for nothing, but you're right, Avraham. Had I not done it for nothing, you might have been without an Olam HaBo. So you see, it is possible to be paid out in full here. To be paid out in full in present value. But the interesting thing is that Avraham is not being talked about being paid out in gold coins. Avraham Avinu is talking about being paid out with life. I should have died when I went into that furnace of fire. I was saved miraculously. I was given life. I should have died when I fought the five kings. Naturally, there was no way that I could survive that. I survived miraculously. I was given life. And the gift of life, over and above what one's normally entitled to, if one is given miraculous extra life, says Avraham Avinu, that could be one's entire Olam HaBo, could be life. Which is an amazing concept, and Chaim Shmulevitz talks a lot about that. That means that life is more valuable than Olam HaBo. That one can think that one can, as difficult as it is to picture the possibility of being paid out for one's world to come in this world, one thing can give it to one, that's life. And with that, Reb Chaim used to explain the Medrash that says that there were several people who were involved with Paro in planning to annihilate the Jews. Bilam gave advice to Paro as to how to do it, and Eov was one of them. Eov just kept quiet and ran away. And Bilam is killed, and Eov suffers these terrible, terrible sufferings. And asks of Chaim Shmulevitz, it would appear that Eov is punished worse than Bilam. Bilam lives a good life, and eventually he's killed. His life comes to an end, but he had a good and happy and wealthy life. Eov lives a life of absolute sorrow. And who did the worst thing? Bilam advised Paro how to annihilate the Jews. And Eov kept quiet. Surely Eov shouldn't have been punished so severely. So Chaim Shmulevitz shows that a life, even if it's a life of tzoros, a life is a wonderful, there's no way of valuing life. He brings the pasuk from Echo, Mayis Einein Odom Chai. What should a living person ever complain about? Echo says, how can a person who's alive complain? What's he got to complain about? He's got no money, maybe, he's got no family, maybe, he's got no health, maybe he's got nothing, but he's got life. And life is, Avraham Avinu worried that the gift of life might have been his entire Olam HaBo. What there is in life, what pleasure there is in life, what wonder there is in life, what excitement there is in life, what growth possibility there is in life. How can my Yisraelin Odom Chai? How can a living person complain? And Reb Chaim gives the example of a person who's just been told he's won the Operation Hunger million rand. He's got R1 million and he's in tears. And you come up to him and you say, Rabbi, why are you crying? Do you know that you've won this? He says, yes, I know that I've won. So why are you crying? He says, you can't believe my luck, my bad luck. Always happens to me. My bad luck. And he's crying. What's wrong? Always me. I always have such a terrible time. The Rebbe Shem doesn't like me. Nobody likes me. Always. What happened, Rabbi? You've just won R1 million. Forget R1 million. I was having a cup of tea. I dropped the cup on the floor, bro. Always happens to me. What are you talking about? You've got another cup. You've got R1 million. Now you're so in an Adam Chai. So what are you worried about? You've lost all your money. You've lost your health. Chas v'sholem. You're living. You're alive. What are you worried about? What you've lost? A couple of pennies you've lost, and that you're busy spoiling your life with misery over having lost something when you've got life itself. What bigger thing could there be like that? You've just won the million rand, and you're busy complaining about losing your money. What's the importance of your money when you've got life? My Yisrael in Adam Chai. How can a living person complain? And that's why it explains the Chaim Shmuel Levitz. Yaakov was punished with the loss of life when Paro says to him, why? You look so terribly old. And he says, yes, I've had a hard life, that's why I look so old. He's punished with the loss of 37 years, I think it was, of life. There are cut off. He loses 37 years of life. He dies 37 years earlier than he should have, for looking old and for acting old, when he didn't have the right to do so. He was already an old man, but he looked older than his years, and he shouldn't have. How can a person look miserable and be miserable when he's got life? So much in life. How can a person look miserable? How can a person feel miserable? And so Avraham Avinu worries that he's lost all his Olam Haba because he's been given life. More life than he deserves. When he came out of, he didn't deserve to come out of that Kibshon Hayesh, out of that furnace. That's miraculous. So he was given a gift of life. That's invaluable. There's no way you can value that. And therefore he feels it must have come from his Olam Haba. And again, when he fights with the kings, what is it about life that is so special that it has something to it that's even greater than Olam Haba? One level of understanding it is that the Medrash says in Pirkei Avos that Yofesho Achas Be'olam Hazeh Be'tshuva Ma'asim Tovim Mikol Chaya Olam Haba, that one moment of tshuva and good deeds in this world is worth much more than the whole of the world to come, because one can achieve more greatness. In Olam Haba you can't achieve anything, you're receiving the benefits. But achievement is in this world. And the thrill of achievement, there's nothing like the thrill of achievement. Even in Olam Haba, there's nothing like it. And achievement, one has to do, that doesn't mean necessarily material achievement. Spiritual achievement, coming closer to the Ribbono Shel Olam, taking a step closer, conquering oneself, commanding oneself, pushing oneself that little step further to be able to do something extra, to be able to do something fine, to be able to do something great. One moment of tshuva and ma'asim tovim can bring a person more sense of achievement, more sense of greatness within himself, of closeness to the Ribbono Shel Olam, than all of one's Olam Haba. And that's why the Torah doesn't make much of this Olam Haba business, and that's one of the reasons that we're so disturbed about this tendency towards mysticism and this need to study mysticism and to learn about mysticism, because it distracts us from the real thing. The Torah doesn't talk about Olam Haba. It's in veiled hints you'll find mention about Olam Haba. But the Mesillas Yeshorim says that this world is just a corridor to Olam Haba. The real thing is Olam Haba, but we don't see it mentioned. The Torah doesn't want us to be involved with Olam Haba. Olam Hazeh is much more important. If we handle our Olam Hazeh right, Olam Haba will look after itself. Olam Hazeh is much more important. The way we live in this world is what's important. And Shor Achas, one moment of Tshuva Ma'asim Tovim, of spiritual elevation, it brings within oneself a greater sense of accomplishment than all of one's Olam Haba. And that's why the tzaddikim all clung to life the way they did. They didn't want to die. In other religions you find that the saints are quite happy to die. They're going to God and they're going back to their origins, and their soul will be pure again, and they feel a certain happiness in it. Our tzaddikim don't feel that way at all. And that's why we mourn when a person dies, not just for ourselves, because they've lost opportunity for further growth as well. There's an end. Death is an end to something very great. It's an end to life. And it doesn't matter if it's a poor life. And it doesn't matter if it's a life of hardship. It's a life. And as long as a person is alive, what he can achieve in one moment, what he can accomplish in one moment within himself, never mind within anybody else, that's Chaim, that's life. But we see in this very medrash that we started learning, we see another unique quality to life. she says, and this brings us to the second question that we asked, and that is that she, the contradiction, she says, I don't want you to come up into Olam Haba and find that your table is missing something and your friend's table is full. Rebbe says, I'll make it good. She says, you can't. So we ask him, either way, if everybody's in a separate world, you won't notice that your table's missing something that the other table hasn't got. And if everybody's in the same world, then Rebbe will be able to help you out, as he promised. There seems to be a contradiction. But Tzelzer Rav says something very amazing in that same Shmuz, and he says, that pleasure is a spiritual function, actually. That even when we get pleasure from physical things, it's that pleasure is, we're tasting something of the spirituality of the thing, because pleasure is not physical. Getting pleasure from something is a touch of something spiritual. It's just a little, the absolute superficial taste of the true pleasure that thing can really contain. So the Krugerrands, you can get pleasure from the Krugerrands tumbling out of the sides of the mountain. That can give one a great sense of pleasure. That pleasure is just a touch of the kind of pleasure that you would get if you turned those Krugerrands back into their spiritual equivalent, into their future value, and you got it there. The same as the people who sell you long-term insurance policies and so on will tell you also that it's true. Your 100 rand a month can bring you a certain pleasure, but if you put that 100 rand a month into a policy, which in 15 years' time or 25 years' time or 40 years' time is going to pay you out 40,000 rand, it's much greater pleasure than the sum of all the pleasures that you get from your little 100 rands which you would have spent instead of investing. And that pleasure, whenever the Chazal talk about describing the pleasure of Olam Haba, they put it in a food analogy, which is very interesting. And here's one of them at the end of Perek Shoel in Shabbos. Omer Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Moshal Melech, this goes on a posuk in Koheles, where the posuk says, "Bechol eis yiyu begodecha levonim," at all times your clothes should be clean and smart. "V'shemen al roshcho al yechzor," and don't for a moment leave oil off your head. In other words, you should always be meticulously groomed, which doesn't mean in a literal sense only; it means also in a spiritual sense, as Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai explains. Moshal Melech shizimen es avodov l'suuda. For example, a king who says to his servants, "I want you to come and have a meal with me sometime." The loy kovel loyim zman, and he didn't fix a time. He didn't say on such and such a day, at such and such a place, at such and such a time. He just said, "I want you to have dinner with me." Pichin shubohim kishtu es atzmon v'yoshvu apesach beis hamelech. The clever ones got dressed quickly and groomed themselves and came and waited at the palace. Omru klum chosel lebeis hamelech. They said, "Is there any reason that the king should delay it?" He said, "He wants us to come to dinner. He probably means right now, tonight. Why would there be any delay?" Tipshim shubohim, the stupid ones, holchudim lachtom. They went and carried on working. Omru klum yesh su'udah b'loy tzeirach. If he wants us to come to a meal, he's still going to make the meal. He'll let us know before. There's plenty of time. He can't spring it on us. He's got to prepare the banquet. Befisim bikesh hamelech es avodav. All of a sudden the king comes and says, dinner's ready, and he wants them all to come in. Pikhin shubim nichnasu lefonov kushim kushotim. The wise people come before the king into the banquet hall, and they're all dressed beautifully, and they're all groomed. Va'atipshim nichnasu lefonov kushim meluchlochim. And the foolish ones come in their overalls, and they're dirty, they haven't washed yet, they're unkempt, and they have to come into the banquet hall. Somach hamelech likras pichim. The king was happy to see the clever ones. But koach likras tipshim, and when he saw the foolish ones coming in so badly dressed, he got very upset with them. Omar halolu shikishtu es atzmon lisu'ude yoshvu v'yochlu. So the king said, those who are dressed properly for the meal, please sit down and help yourselves. V'yishtu, and drink. Halalu shaloi kishtu atzmon lisu'ude, those who are not dressed properly for the su'ude, yamdu v'yiru. They can stand on the side, they can watch the others eating, but they can't participate. Chatonu shal Rabbi Meir, mishum Rabbi Meir omer, Rabbi Meir's son-in-law said in the name of Rabbi Meir, af heim nirim kemeshamshim. No, that would be too good for them too. They might look like servants. That's not what had to happen. Elo elu ve'elu yoshvi. They both had to sit down. Halalu uchli, v'halalu re'evim. One lot ate and the other lot stayed hungry. Halalu shoysin, v'halalu tzmein. One lot drank and the other one remained thirsty. The reason that the Chazal put it in the image of eating is, somehow it seems that most physical pleasures revolve around the satisfaction of the need. That's the greatest pleasure. And you can have the most delicious of food, but if you're not hungry, it doesn't help, it doesn't taste all that good. And if you are very hungry, even plain food tastes very good. So the degree of enjoyment is not just a function of the object that you're enjoying. What it really is a function of the need within yourself to have that object. And so if one's clever, one actually learns how to starve oneself of something before you get it. That's an important part of the pleasure principle. People don't like doing it because people don't like causing themselves discomfort. So they try and create all sorts of needs and they get very weird and wonderful ideas, but it's not necessary. If we would simply do as Chazal tell us, Erev Pesach, not to eat matzah so that we can enjoy the matzah. How do you enjoy matzah? Flour and water, that's all baked. It's the most unappetizing food that there can be. But if you don't have any for a while and you don't eat much before the Yom Tov itself, you come into the Yom Tov hungry, you haven't eaten matzah for a while, you're very happy to see the matzah by the time you get around to it at the Seder, and you're able to enjoy it. So sometimes when we have to enjoy plain things, we have to develop the art of enjoyment of those plain things by depriving of us of it first. And somehow it seems to be that the pleasures of Olam Haba are similar, that we are so thirsty for it, we crave it so much, that there's tremendous pleasure in being satisfied in Olam Haba. But here we also get a glimpse into this Chazal that we've just learned, we also get a glimpse as to what Gehenim is. Gehenim is being hungry. You come here, you didn't eat matzah before, you haven't eaten matzah for a month since the beginning of Nisan, you didn't eat anything the day before Pesach, and you've been running around working hard, and you've gone through a long Seder, it's now already past midnight, and you finally come to the meal, with the kleidlach, and the matzah, and the morah, and everything, and you're not allowed to eat. You've got to sit there and watch. Comes the second night, same story, you've got to sit there and watch. The third night, there's your Gehenna. And says the son-in-law of Rabbi Meir, in the name of Rabbi Meir, not that they stood by a little distance, a little way away, and watched. They sit at the table, but they can't eat. To give one an idea of what it is to be in Olam Haba and not be ready for it, and not be prepared for it. That's the image that Rabbi Yochanan and Zakkai gives. The wise people are ready. They know they could be called to Olam Haba at any time, and they want to be ready. So they do mitzvahs and ma'asim and tovim, so they're ready at all times. Other people say, there's still time to do it. I'll prepare myself. I'll still do these things. I'll do tshuva someday. And they can be called in unprepared. And the result is they won't be permitted to eat at the table. Sit at the table, yes, but not participate in the meal. Comes the same question. If Rabbi Shimon Chalafta's wife is right, what's this table that they're all sitting at? Each tzaddik has a world as an olam by himself. What's this table they're sitting at? And the answer is that it's not. It is and it isn't. You sit at the same table and you have a banquet, but you can't do anything for one another. You can't help one another. That's the peculiarity of Olam Haba. Of course, we'll come to Olam Haba, and if we merit it, and if we're on a level, we'll be able to meet up with Moshe Rabbeinu, and with Avram, and with Yitzchak and Yaakov, and with Yosef, and we will be able to meet up with Rabbi Akiva, and with Rabbi Meir, and with the Tanoim, the Amiroim, everybody will be able to meet up with. And with our grandparents, and great-grandparents, and our parents, we'll meet up with everybody, no problem. We'll even be able to communicate. But we won't be able to help each other. That means we could be sitting next to somebody at the table, and he's drawn, and he's hungry, and it can be a beloved one of ours, it can be somebody we love tremendously, and he's sitting there right next to us, terribly hungry, terribly thirsty, and we have to eat in front of him, and we can't give him anything, we can't help him. That's Olam Haba. Very worrying thought. I don't know which is the bigger Gehenna, for the one who's not allowed to eat, or for the one who can't help. And that's what she means when she says to Rebbe, we'll see other people's table have got more than ours. We'll see there's something missing from our table. But you, Rebbe, won't be able to help us. You'll just be able to stand there and shake your head and say, no, but shame, look at their table, shame. They shouldn't have taken that precious stone. But you won't be able to do anything for us. We can't help each other up there. Chesed is a thrill which is allowed only to living people. Chesed is not a privilege which is allowed to people in Olam Haba. That is unique to a living situation, not to the situation of Olam Haba. And that's what life is. Life enables us, apart from anything else, life enables us the greatest thrill of all, which is that thrill of the potency we feel when we help another human being, when we're able to do something for another human being. And we need to treasure that. We'll say you've got to treasure life. What does it mean, treasuring life? It's a big word, it's a big term, it's a big saying. It's so big that it doesn't mean anything. Treasure life. Precious. What does it mean? What aspect of life is so precious? Much of life is better afterwards. What aspect of life is so precious? What can I do here that I can't do elsewhere? So we've said there are two things that I can only do here. The one is the sense of achievement. You can achieve here. And any moment of life that is not used for achievement is wasted. Any moment of life that is not used to achieve is a moment that one might as well not be alive. That you can sit and have pleasure, you can have in Olam Haba as well. To achieve, that you can't do in Olam Haba. That we can only do here. And in one moment we can achieve more than we can achieve in the whole of Olam Haba. Every moment is filled with potential for achievement on any level that we choose to achieve. And the other thing that is unique about life in Olam Hazeh is the possibility of chesed. That tremendous thrill of being able to help one another. Now, helping one another is a strange thing because there's a cost involved, and sometimes that cost spoils it for us. But to really understand the thrill of helping one another, you've got to think of that help which doesn't cost anything. Think of even the little pleasures. You're standing in a room and you smile at somebody and he smiles back at you. Just that. You've given somebody recognition and pleasure. That's all. You shake somebody's hand in a nice warm way that makes them feel good, and you notice it. You get that feedback. You notice that you've made his day for him. See a person who looks troubled, who looks miserable, you put your arm around him, comfort him, give him a word of encouragement, and you see the smile on his face, you see the sense of gratitude within him. How do you feel? That's something which has cost you nothing at all and gives tremendous feedback. And how much more when one helps in more substantial ways? Not just with money, but when one helps people, when one attends to people in whatever way one can. One of the very beautiful things that Rabbi Tversky said in the name of his mother, and I think the things that he said in the name of his mother in the various talks he gave were the finest of all the things he quoted or said, were the things he said in his mother's name. She must be a very wonderful lady. One of the many things he said in her name was, she used to tell him when he was a little boy, always be careful, she used to say, that you don't find yourself busying yourself with the spiritual welfare of others and the material welfare of yourself. Do it the other way around. Worry about your own spiritual welfare and worry about the physical welfare of others. Don't go around making everybody frum. That's their own business. Make yourself frum. If you're worried about others, see that they've got what to eat, see that they've got where to sleep, see that they've got jobs, see, that's what you do. If you're worried about others, that's what you do for them. And one has to remember that and one has to realize that. Being frum is not worrying about the frumkeit of others and the materialism of oneself. It's worrying about the frumkeit of oneself and the material needs of other people. That's terribly important. And there's tremendous frumkeit in that. There's tremendous spirituality in that. That's something unique. You can't do that in Olam Haemes. In Olam Haemes, you can be sitting next to a starving person who can be a beloved friend or member of your family and you can do nothing to help them. It can be a child of yours. It can be a parent. It can be a brother or sister. And there's nothing you can do to help. And then you sit thinking there, what are the opportunities I had to help when I was down there that I didn't use? The greatest thing in the world to help another person, to feel close to another person, to overcome the sense of alienation and aloneness and loneliness that existed between people. What I could have done to break those barriers had I realized how precious it was. Now I realize how precious it is because I can't do it. That's something when we talk about life is precious, treasure it. That's what we mean. The possibility, the opportunity to do something for one another is so special, is so precious. Use it. Don't let an opportunity like that go. Chesed, tzedakah, such an opportunity. What is there more worthwhile to do with one's resources? Whether it's time resources or financial resources or talents or whatever. What is there more worthwhile to do than to do that which you can't do in Olam Haba? To help another person. To make it easier for another person. One of the reasons we don't do it is because we feel threatened by other people. And the reason we feel threatened by other people is because we don't feel all that secure within ourselves. And one of the points I always make in the business ethics talks is that the first principle in ethics is the ahavta l'reacha kamecha. Every civilization accepts that. Love your neighbor as yourself is where it all starts. And it's amazing how superficial the goyim's understanding of the Torah is because they don't have a Torah Shebaal Peh, so they've never really analyzed it. Because they're always stumped when I say to them, why does it say as yourself and not more than yourself? Why doesn't it say love your fellow more than yourself? Love your friend more than yourself? Why is it limited to the way you love yourself? And as soon as I say it, they realize the answer. Because it is not possible to love somebody else more than you love yourself. It's important to love yourself before you can love others. So one of the most important things we need for ourselves is self-esteem. We need a good self-image, which is something we don't have. It's something that none of us have. It's something that we're all troubled by. It's the most amazing thing. It's another thing that's then the importance of knowing how to accept chesed also. Terribly important. Not to deprive a person of the opportunity to give by not being able to know how to accept chesed. Very, very important. And very often one sees some good material that's been written on knowing how to accept a compliment. Sometimes a person says to you, "You're looking very good today," or the person undermines it and says, "No, it's nothing." The person says, "That was very clever what you said." He says, "No, it's nothing." That's not modesty. You're actually making the person who gave you the compliment feel it's wasted, feels deflated. He gave you the compliment because he wanted the feedback of seeing you glow. And then he could feel, "Look what I did, I made him happy." So he comes along and says, "You know, that question you asked in the shoe was really fantastic today." So what have you done? You've just deprived him of the opportunity of doing chesed, and he'll find it harder to do it next time, not just to you, but to anybody else. Whereas if one turns around and says, "Did you really think so? That means so much to me that you thought it was something good." So you've already returned the compliment. You've made him feel good. That's chesed. That's chesed being received and reciprocated simultaneously. One has to know how to accept the compliment too. "Thank you very much. That's so nice of you to say that. It means so much to me that you do." And when one receives physical chesed too, you invite somebody for dinner and they bring you a box of chocolates. "Thank you so much." They say, "Thank you so much for having me. How wonderful of you to have me." So you could say, which is something we say and which is correct in a way, "Oh, it's nothing, please don't worry about it. We always eat like this. No, nothing special for you." And we say that in a way not to make him feel that we went out of our way. But there's another way of doing it too. "That means so much to me that you noticed how I went out of my way for you. It means so much. Thank you for that box of chocolates. It means so much to me. What does that make the giver of the box of chocolates for you?" It's important. It was a gesture that was received. If one just takes it and one doesn't say anything, and one doesn't take it at all, it's terrible. And so it is with all areas of chesed. Sometimes it's very hard to take chesed. Sometimes it's very hard to take a compliment. It's very hard to take a gift. It's very hard, never sometimes when one needs even to take a loan, or one needs to take charity. Very, very hard. But one needs to understand that you're depriving the giver of an enormous opportunity that he has only in Olam Hazeh. He doesn't have it in Olam Haba. If one doesn't develop the skills of knowing how to take it in a way that makes the giver feel good, there's nothing wrong with him feeling good. He must feel good. And you've got to make him feel good, because that makes it all worthwhile for him. That's what one has to be able to do in the receiving of it. And sometimes people feel that they're great tzaddikim when they refuse to take help. It's not tzaddikim at all. Not tzaddikim at all. That's very nasty, very selfish, and very hard not to be able to take chesed, not to be able to take a compliment, not to be able to take a gift, not to be able to take help, not to be able to take encouragement, not to be able to take a loan sometimes when one needs it, or even charity when one needs it. There's a way of doing these things where one can make the giver feel important, where one can make the giver feel special. And of course, if one doesn't want a feeling of indebtedness, there's a simple way to handle it. The way to handle it is not, "No thank you, I don't want it." The way to handle it is, "Thank you very much. That box of chocolates is very special to me. And I will reciprocate. I'll give you more than a box of chocolates one day. Or that vase of flowers was very special to me, and one can give back more. Or that loan you gave me, I know I can't give you interest and all the rest of it, but believe me, you'll get nothing from me, much more than the money you lent me." There are ways of getting out of the indebtedness other than rejecting the help. Rejecting the help is no tzidkus. The tzidkus is to reciprocate for the help, not to reject the help. And that's something that one finds altogether in the whole difficulty of handling indebtedness. One of the purposes of chesed, the Chazal say, is to be ma'ar b'sholem. Part of the purpose is that it does just that. It makes friends, it makes people close to one another. And we're living in a time of great, great alienation. People feel very distant from one another, and in our society here in this country at this time, more than anywhere else and more than at any other time. And people often comment, and it's true, that the big walls around the homes are symbolic of the way we're living. The loneliness, the separateness, the fear, the insecurity are not just physical things, they're emotional things. It's an amazing thing, it's very, very disturbing. I've got neighbors that I've lived next door to for goodness me, it's now 13 years. I don't know their names. I don't know who they are. Bump into them, occasionally see them. Don't know who they are. It's an unbelievable sense of isolation. And why don't we break those barriers? They're hard barriers to break. Somebody has to take the first step. And how is the first step taken? With chesed. It's taken with an act of chesed. And then if the chesed is not received properly, it's worse than if the attempt was never made. You're back. You're beyond square one. You're not even at square one yet. You've got to start from beneath square one when you start again. One has to be able to know how to take a chesed, and yes, sure, one doesn't want to feel indebtedness. That's tzidkus. I don't want to be indebted, that's tzidkus. Now what do I do about it? That's righteousness. I have two options. The one is to throw the box of chocolates back in your face and say, no thank you, I don't want to be indebted to you. And the other is to say, thank you very much, that means so much to me. I'm going to enjoy them a lot, and I'll think of you each time I have a chocolate. And then you make sure that you have the opportunity to reciprocate in a greater way than a box of chocolates, that you don't remain indebted. And then he'll feel indebted, and he'll feel reciprocated. That's Marbe Sholem. That's how we do it. But we need to develop that art, and we need to develop that skill. That's the uniqueness of Olam Hazeh. Olam Hazeh is a place where we can achieve. Olam Hazeh is a place where we can accomplish. Olam Hazeh is a place where we can break down the barriers between each other, where we can overcome the loneliness and the sense of aloneness that each of us feels, where we can help each other build our sense of self-esteem, our sense of self-worth, and through that we can be Marbe Sholem, and Sholem is the Ribbono Shel'olam's name himself. As people become closer, as people develop chesed between themselves, as people make themselves Sholem, they make themselves whole, not just within themselves but in their interrelationship, so the Shechina of the Ribbono Shel'olam is among us so much more, and the closeness we can achieve to Hashem here exceeds even Kol Chayei HaOlam HaBo.